Hi, this is John Hockenberry, and speaking to someone who clearly loves to listen at the time of their choosing, you should give the WNYC app a try, you know? Not only can you listen to this program, but it'll also automatically search for the kinds of stories and subjects you like. It's really cool, and it's free. There are other apps and radio stations available, but thanks for listening. Here's today's program. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for joining us. This hour, the latest from Syria and the latest from the Ebola crisis in West Africa will give you a new view of Mars, courtesy of a scientist who spent his entire career studying the red planet, and a very old view of New York City this hour, but it may be new to you, the Big Apple through the eyes of Woody Guthrie, who spent so much time creating the songs of the 20th century during the 1940s, 50s, and 60s on the streets of Manhattan. But first, the U.S. is leading a coalition that has launched a series of strikes on Islamic State group targets in Syria. The president elaborated on the operation in a statement on the White House lawn.
Earlier this month, I outlined for the American people our strategy to confront the threat posed by the terrorist group known as ISIL. I made clear that as part of this campaign, the United States would take action against targets in both Iraq and Syria so that these terrorists can't find safe haven anywhere. I also made clear that America would act as part of a broad coalition, and that's exactly what we've done.
That broad coalition outlined by the president signals a Middle East war pitting Arab nations against ISIS-controlled territory in Syria. Lieutenant General William Mayville Jr., director for operations with the Joint Chiefs of Staff at the Pentagon briefing today, said that at this point the operation is not a manhunt for ISIS commanders.
We did not target individual leaders. We did, however, target command and control nodes. And we looked over time as we developed those targets for patterns of life where leadership would routinely go. And if they were there, that usually was an indication of a command and control node. But we did not specifically target individuals.
In a moment, a Syrian American who has waited years for the U.S. to take action in her country gives us her emotional reaction to the latest U.S. military operation. And she shares her worries that it may have come too late. But as it stands now, the U.S. is battling ISIS from the air along with Bahrain, Jordan, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates. Those are the nations that participated in or supported the airstrikes against Islamic State targets in some way. Is this symbolic or strategic? Joining us now is Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick. What are your sources telling you, Todd?
Hi, John. Well, we can hear directly from William Mayfield to that question in the Pentagon briefing when asked sort of the proportion of strikes between the United States and those other partners, those Arab partners that you mentioned, John, said that the preponderance of the action, let's say the preponderance of the missiles launched and the bombs dropped by the United States, no exact proportion given, 70, 60, 80%, we don't know, but he said the preponderance of that force by the United States, not the partners.
And what kinds of weapons were used? We certainly know that Tomahawk missiles were used. There were video pictures of fighter jets taking off from aircraft carriers. There was also a discussion in the original statement that the U.S. took action, perhaps on the ground, against groups calling themselves Khorasan, or at least the Pentagon is calling them Khorasan, that were apparently ready to make imminent attacks on the U.S. and Western targets. Anything more on that?
And that's a brand new development and something that's got a lot of people in Washington interested because, John, hardly anyone has heard of Khorasan before today. Now, James Clapper, the director of national intelligence, did mention last week at an intelligence conference, he did mention Khorasan and said that they might be as bad or worse a threat than ISIS itself. That's according to ABC News. But it hasn't been mentioned in any White House briefings. It hasn't been mentioned in background briefings with senior administration officials. And it was the first time that a lot of people in Washington had heard of the group. It's interesting because of the targeting and also because of the debate that's going on about the legal justification for these strikes by the United States under international law. Of course, we've had lots of arguments in this country about preemption. That's from another era, or from the beginning of this era, if you will, and whether or not there's an imminent threat on the part of ISIS to the United States, and whether they're really part of al-Qaeda. Of course, the president is kind of going toe-to-toe with Congress about whether or not he needs new authorization. He can fight al-Qaeda, but is ISIS al-Qaeda? Well, the Khorasan group is widely accepted to the extent that they're known to be part of al-Qaeda, and it might give you a sense of sort of the merging of a legal justification as the president heads to the United Nations in front of the international community.
Well, this is the puzzle here, because Khorasan actually refers to a territory that's largely in Iran. I mean, if you use the name, Khorasan is a territory in Iran. It's a province in Iran. Khorasan, the group that was described in the original statement this morning and in subsequent briefings, is apparently a group that is made up of former al-Qaeda operatives, very close to Osama bin Laden, one very, very close to Osama bin Laden, all on the U.S. target list. So in a sense, we're moving closer to al-Qaeda, and that, of course, gets us closer to the original justification that was voted right after 9/11 and has very little to do with ISIS. If they're distinct groups, it makes you wonder if the authorization for ISIS is still valid.
Just jump one or two more rocks back into history and you'll remember the nexus between ISIS itself and al-Qaeda in Iraq back during the Iraq War. Before ISIS split off because of some ideological and tactical differences, John Kerry, the Secretary of State, told senators just last week, John, that the reason the president is authorized to do these strikes, both in Iraq and in Syria, as we saw late last night, is because all ISIS did, in his words, were sort of change their brand, make some semantical differences, call themselves something different. Well, that doesn't matter to us. They're still al-Qaeda, even if they pretended to have a little bit of a fight with Zarqawi and other al-Qaeda figures from Iraq. Congress, of course, isn't buying it. Democrats and many Republicans say they'll come back after the election and insist on a new authorization. But in the meantime, just today, John, the president writing to Congress formal letters under the War Powers Act, notifying Congress that he's taken military action in both Iraq and in Syria, saying he can't predict how long those engagements will take place. But under the law, the president, of course, takes a war powers imperative to make these strikes and simply notifies Congress that they're going on. He did that today.
Of course, that assumes that the war powers dance is something that anyone's going to take seriously at this point. You know, regarding ISIS and al-Qaeda, it's more than just ideological differences between ISIS and al-Qaeda. ISIS is apparently, and according to the sources that we talked to this morning, killed senior members of al-Qaeda. That's part of the, I mean, they're actively at war with al-Qaeda.
And then you see all of the different imperatives between all these different factions in the Middle East and what makes it so very complicated now. Of course, ISIS is against Assad, and so are we. ISIS is also against the government of Saudi Arabia, who is our ally in this case, although they all be Sunni, at least ISIS and the Saudi government. So you see how very complicated this is, and a lot of warnings from members of Congress and others in Washington that as the alliances shift, it's one thing to get support for airstrikes initially. That's common. As this drags on to months and possibly years, the strategy, the tactics, and the politics become much, much more complicated.
Well, as you've laid out there, all of those will be questions for Congress as they try to elaborate exactly what kind of support we got from Arab coalition members and where this can go, this operation can go. Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick, thanks so much.
Pleasure, John.
And now a voice from someone with a lot at stake inside Syria. Basma Akbik left Syria 20 years ago for the United States, but Basma still has family in Damascus. She currently lives in Cincinnati, Ohio, where she's been watching developments very, very closely. Basma Akbik, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So has the war begun in your mind? Has the United States finally weighed into your country after so many years?
Well, I don't know if it's weighing in or you know, it's going to do any good to the country right now. In my opinion, you cannot treat the metastasis without taking the original tumor. We don't have to forget that ISIS was created by the regime. ISIS was born because of what was going on in Syria for 4 years. Syria has been under fire for 4 years. 250,000 people at least were killed. And now, in my opinion, it's very good that hopefully we're going to get rid of ISIS, possibly. But more civilians are going to pay the price because ISIS now is embedded, actually, in the civilians' area. They got the warning soon enough to just be spread in between the civilians.
So in the midst of this airstrike, you feel a real deep sadness right now.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm looking to my country now and I'm praying that Syria does not become another Afghanistan.
Or Iraq, for that matter.
Or Iraq. I mean, yeah, but in this excuse of fighting the terrorism, we're not looking at the original reason, at the big reason. Those are ideologies they are being feeded by a bigger thing. It's a bigger than only ISIS. Airstrikes won't do the job.
How's your family? Yeah. How's your family in Damascus, Basma?
Well, it's so painful to wake up every morning and hearing about a shell or a mortar, you know, falling here and there next to our building. And it's very hard to hear that our neighbor got killed and that the worker at the hospital next to my building was killed. And, you know, my friend was kidnapped and my friend's daughter was kidnapped. It's just so hard and scary to wake up every morning to hear these bad news. I don't know when the shell or the mortar is going to hit one of my family members. It is so scary. I have an elderly parent who are living now by themselves. All their kids just, you know, are spread around the world and they don't have anyone to help them.
And this news today doesn't make you feel that they're safer at all.
Well, my parents are in Damascus. What I'm afraid of that this thing that's happening right now in northern Syria is going to spread to all the cities in Syria, including Damascus. I don't know what's going to happen. What are the reactions from the regime or from other, you know, people who are kind of like sleeping cells right now? I don't know what the reaction will be, what the excuses the regime's going to take to burn Damascus, as they promised. They promised to burn Damascus.
Basma, let me ask you a question about something we're hearing. The U.S. has attacked cells of some organization called Khorasan, which leaks from Washington over the weekend told us was a new group that has, you know, directly threatened the United States. We're learning about this for the first time, but in talking with the your friends and family in Syria, have you known about this for a while?
No, I was going to talk to you about this, proving my point that this is only an ideology and it's going to spread and spread and spread. So Khorasan, I only heard about it from the Al Arabiya news channel since I live here in the States. And it's we heard about it. We saw who the leader is, and he was connected to Al-Qaeda during September 11.
So it doesn't surprise you, this Khorasan.
Oh, no. And I was expecting more and more of this. Syria became now the refuge for all these extremism because they want to, in their minds, to do something. They've been brainwashed. You listen to them on the news and what their ideology is, and you think, oh, my God, is this for real?
Basma Akbik left Syria 20 years ago for the U.S., lives in Cincinnati, Ohio. She has family in Syria. Her husband is a doctor in a refugee camp in Jordan, and her elderly parents and grandparents are in Damascus. Thank you so much, Basma.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International, in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
These doctors and nurses are about to step through a gateway to another world.
Father, for leading us forward and treat our brothers and sisters, Lord. Father, we pray for you.
Though they are representatives of medical science, fighters in the Ebola crisis in Liberia, they say a prayer to keep them safe as they enter the high-risk ward of a clinic.
My name is Adam Levine. I'm an emergency physician. I work at Rhode Island Hospital in Providence, Rhode Island, and I'm part of the emergency response team for International Medical Corps.
In a different part of Liberia, Dr. Adam Levine is also praying and working to help people that the international aid effort has not yet reached.
I've been here in Liberia for the past 3 weeks, helping International Medical Corps launch its first Ebola treatment unit in Bong County, which is about 120 miles north of Monrovia. It's a rural county that has not had an Ebola treatment unit before now, but has the third highest number of Ebola patients in Liberia at this time.
Dr. Levine filed that diary entry on Thursday, September 18th, just as his clinic in Bong County opened its doors. Levine agreed to spend a few minutes of his busy days recording a diary of his experiences, the frantic efforts to make progress, and the heartbreaking moments when people slip beyond reach.
We have admitted about 8 patients so far. Of those, 7 are still alive. Our first patient, who was a 12-year-old boy, came in with his father. He died about 10 minutes or so after admission, which was really hard to see. We're hoping over the next couple weeks to be able to expand our capacity and take in more patients till we can hopefully meet the demand here in the county.
It is Dr. Levine's determination, and you can hear it in his voice, to outflank the spreading virus that keeps his morale high and fuels the hope that there will be help for all who need it.
The past week has really been a roller coaster. First this really mad dash of working day and night to get everything ready for the facility, to make sure it was set up properly, to hire our staff locally and to train them, to make sure that we had the infrastructure just right and all the personal protective equipment in place, all of the medications that we needed. So that was a lot of work. And we were able to open up on Monday, the 15th of September, on time, which was really wonderful and a big high in many ways.
September 19th, the clinic's fourth day of operations.
We did also have our first two discharges today, patients who tested negative for Ebola, and that was very happy news for them. Though it was sad, actually, for one of our discharges. He came in at the same time as his brother. They both came in together, and he was negative, but his brother came back positive. So when we gave him the news that he was negative for Ebola, he was quite elated, but then when he heard that his brother came back positive, he looked pretty dejected. But we're still hopeful that his brother will pull through, and we're going to take it one day at a time.
This close to patients, Dr. Levine can see the ravages of Ebola. On day five, the infected father of that little boy who died on the first day starts to decline. His name is Rennie.
He's been getting more disoriented and confused over the last few days, having more diarrhea, unable to get to the toilet. And it makes it very difficult because we can only really go in for an hour at a time, and we probably have four or five shifts a day going in. So most of the time, the patients are there alone without anyone really taking care of them. So Randy spent a lot of time in his own feces towards the end. He died last night. We're going to bury him today next to his son in our small graveyard here. And unfortunately, don't think that there's going to be any family available to attend at this point.
Monday, September 22nd, nearly a month of working in Liberia.
It's just past midnight now. I'm working the overnight shift at our Ebola treatment unit here in Bong County. It's our seventh day of operation now. There are a lot of bugs out at night, giant moths and beetles and crickets and all of these little termites that fly around. We had five admissions today, and so beginning of the shift was a lot of catching up and meeting the new patients and learning a little bit about them. One of the new patients, unfortunately, is an 11-year-old girl, and she's already quite sick. She has some bleeding from her gums, and she's breathing very deeply, and I'm pretty certain that she won't make it to the morning.
Treating Ebola, Dr. Levine says, is a suspenseful waiting game. Will a patient be in the 50% who survive or the other half who don't? For the infected, the answer to that question takes a harrowing week to learn.
We have one patient, Comfort, who's actually a operating room nurse, and she got sick about a week and a half ago. She was probably infected by one of her coworkers, who was an ambulance driver, who had been infected while helping a patient into an ambulance. And, you know, at first she seemed pretty ill. She was having a lot of diarrhea, but now her diarrhea stopped, and she does seem to be getting a little bit better. She's right at that kind of 7 to 10 day mark where people either tend to start recovering or to get much worse much quicker at this point. So hopefully she'll take that first course.
Latest word from Dr. Levine, Comfort is doing better. But another patient, Elijah, 14 years old, just beginning his life or death wait. Can he make it a week?
We just got his test result back today that he's positive for Ebola, and we gave him the news. I think that's been really hard on him. He seems pretty depressed. So hopefully we'll have one of our psychosocial officers come talk with him in the morning. I also asked one of the other positive patients on the confirmed ward to kind of spend a little bit of time with Elijah and hopefully, help him through it.
Dr. Adam Levine is a Rhode Island Hospital emergency medicine physician and a volunteer with the International Medical Corps in Liberia, keeping a diary for us on the front lines of a faraway war. The Ebola virus can't reach us, but Dr. Levine's humanity certainly can. If you have a reaction to Dr. Levine's story, please reach out. We'll make sure your comments reach him, working hard in Liberia. as promised, two views of the planet Mars this week. The NASA Mars Atmosphere and Volatile Evolution Mission, otherwise known as MAVEN, is now circling around in the 35-hour loop of Mars's orbit, trying to detect what might have happened to Mars' once rich atmosphere. And tonight, India's Mars Orbiter Mission, or MOM, will also join the party around Mars. It means more data for Bruce Jakovsky, who's principal investigator for the NASA mission and professor of planetary science at the University of Colorado Boulder and a longtime observer of Mars. Professor, welcome.
Thank you. My pleasure to be here.
So more orbiters just means more data. You're just happy to look at any data coming from Mars, Indian, Chinese, American, whatever.
Absolutely. Science doesn't know the boundaries between countries, and we're excited for all of the missions, all of the data we're going to get.
You know, it's a great sentiment on this day where bombing is taking place around the world in a very near Earth orbit. But thinking about Mars, what is the atmosphere and the mystery about the atmosphere, and how can the MAVEN orbiter help to solve it?
The climate on Mars today is a very cold and dry climate. It's one that wouldn't allow liquid water to be stable. If you put water there, it would evaporate or freeze very quickly. Despite that, we see a lot of geological evidence that ancient Mars did have liquid water flowing over it. So why was the temperature warmer back then, and what happened to the atmosphere to change it? MAVEN is all about trying to understand where the water went, where the CO2 that must have created an early thick greenhouse atmosphere went, and we're going to learn about that by studying the top of the atmosphere. We think there's a lot of evidence that a lot of the gas from the atmosphere was lost to space. And we're going to look at the processes by which that can happen and infer how much gas has been removed.
So the logic is, if there's evidence of water on the surface, there must have been some kind of atmosphere to help hold it there and prevent it from evaporating. What scenarios might have dragged the atmosphere away?
Well, we think that, first, you've got it absolutely right in terms of what we think happened. And we think that the solar wind and high-energy sunlight in the ultraviolet was able to strip away the atmosphere. The early sun was much more intense, and we think that the atmosphere would have been thicker back then, maybe 4 billion years ago, and that the solar wind could have dragged it away. We can't go back in time and look at what happened 4 billion years ago, but we can see how the solar wind interacts with the top of the atmosphere today and learn about how those processes operate.
Is there a lesson possibly for planet Earth here in the sense that if the Martian atmosphere reached some kind of, I hate to use this term, tipping point, it could then be subject to the forces of the solar wind and that our atmosphere may be on some sort of trajectory to reach the same kind of vulnerability?
There's a big difference between the Earth and Mars atmosphere in this case, and that is that Earth has a global magnetic field. And what that does is it keeps the solar wind from hitting the atmosphere directly. So Earth is protected. Mars today doesn't have a magnetic field, so it's vulnerable. We think that in its earliest history, Mars might have had one, and that the turn off of that magnetic field allowed the turn on of the solar wind stripping. However, by looking at how these processes operate at Mars, that does help us to understand how the sun and the solar wind interact with the Earth environment, because we're seeing the same processes operate in a different environment.
Wow, that is outrageous. The more we learn about Mars, the more we learn just how fragile and special the conditions of our Earth atmosphere is.
Well, you've hit it exactly. What we're trying to do is learn about the history of the climate on Mars, but really what we're learning about is what controls the habitability of a planet. Why did Mars go from a planet that had liquid water that may have been able to sustain life to one that can't? And we can apply this to understanding planets elsewhere and what the distribution of the habitability of the galaxy might be.
Well, Bruce, thanks so much. Bruce Jakovsky is principal investigator for the MAVEN Mars Atmosphere and Volatile Evolution Mission. Boy, I said that well. That's the MAVEN mission that's orbiting around Mars even as we speak. He's professor at the University of Colorado in Boulder. Bruce, thanks so much.
Thank you.
I'm sticking to the union.
voices of an era, singing a song about workers we don't hear very much anymore. You may recognize the late Pete Seeger in there, and the voice of the man who wrote this song, because women workers demanded their own union song. Woody Guthrie was happy to oblige. Woody was always a charmer with the ladies. The so-called Oklahoma cowboy was as handsome as he was talented. He sang the songs of 20th century America for more than a quarter century. "This Land Is Your Land" is his love song to the open road, but it was written in Midtown Manhattan, where Guthrie lived after hitchhiking across the country back in 1940.
There's a lot of intellectual activity going on. There's a lot of artistic activity going on, collaborating with all the political and intellectual ideas of the times. It's really a hotbed.
Woody Guthrie's daughter, Nora, was only 17 when her father passed away. She always wanted to convey her dad's love affair with the city, where he wrote 600 songs. The audiobook, My Name is New York, Ramblin' Around Woody Guthrie's Town, is a musical tour guide of a New York City largely gone, but alive and well in the voice of a timeless musical legend.
I have to confess, it wasn't until I actually sat down and looked at the lyrics of This Land Is Your Land, the original lyric, and I noticed at the bottom of the page that it said, written at Hanover House, 6th Avenue and 43rd Street. And I kind of like did a double take. And I went around to a couple of people and said, did you know that This Land was written in New York City? And nobody really had that perception of it. Everyone assumed that he had written it in Oklahoma or rambling around the country or something like that. And that kind of sparked my interest. Like, well, if he wrote This Land in New York, what else did he write in New York?
As I went a walk in that ribbon of highway, I saw above me that endless skyway, saw below me that golden valley. This land was made for you and me.
And then I really went through about 3,000 lyrics altogether, looking for these annotations on the bottom of the pages, and realized that so many of the songs that we really consider classics of his, like Vigilante Man, Hard Travelin', Tom Joad, Reuben James, were all written in Manhattan.
And here's Pete Seeger talking about that song, Tom Joad, which of course is inspired by the character in Grapes of Wrath.
When he sat right down and started typing, probably, I don't remember him referring to any pieces of paper, but maybe he had scribbled down some ideas. My friend came in and he said, "That's all right, keep typing, I'm going to go to sleep." And he curled up on his bed and went to sleep. And Woody kept typing away, and he'd think a little bit, kept typing away. He had a half-gallon jug of wine, as I remember. Finally, I got sleepy, and I wasn't being of any help to him, so I went to sleep. In the morning, my friend and I woke up, and there was Woody, sound asleep on the floor, and the Ballad of Tom Joad was finished on the desk there.
Tom Joad got out of the old McAllister pen. There he got his parole.
Well, it's real goosebumps to hear that story and hear that song. And only a half-gallon bottle of wine. Right?
That's all that Pete noticed.
Light night, yeah, exactly.
But, you know, it's true, like, hearing his voice, I was reminded, personally for me, working on the project and hearing the voices of all of these people that I grew up with, from Pete to Sonny Terry, Brownie McGee, Bess Hawes, Sis Cunningham, that are on the project. And that's never been done before, where you hear the stories not through a biographer's words or perception, but really from the people who were sitting right there with him, taking in the vibe of what it was like working with him, writing with him, drinking with him. All of these different voices coming in and really giving you a very, very human, immediate sense of what Woody Guthrie was like.
So, Nora, how did this project change your sense of New York, going back to all of these places and evoking all of these places where so much happened?
Well, you can clearly see how New York and the ambiance and the people that he met there at the time absolutely chiseled his destiny. Before that, he was somewhat of a hillbilly singer, talented, yes, but he really didn't have a vision of where he was going or what he could do with his music. And coming to New York, primarily meeting people like Alan Lomax and Mo Ash, These were the two people who really chiseled his career. Alan Lomax, by taking him down to the Library of Congress within weeks of his arrival in New York, not years. Within weeks, he was down at the Library of Congress recording.
My name's New York. I've been struck by the winds. Froze up and blistered and struck down again. Been struck by my rich folks, struck by my bums, struck by my mansions, and struck by my slums.
In Woody's time, the connections, like I was talking about before, the politics of the time, the strong union movement, there were a lot of issues that artists were very, very, very involved in. I kind of miss that right now. I kind of miss that hotbed of creativity where people should be using or could be using their creativity to make a dent in the flow of things. You know, New York City has changed so much. And it's kind of now the financial capital of the world instead of the intellectual capital of the world, maybe.
And if you wander up 6th Avenue to 43rd Street, there's the headquarters of HBO and an investment bank right across the street. So
yeah, Bank of America is across the street. You know, that was, listen, I'm not arguing with time. Time changes things. What it's really important for everyone to get from this project is how important it is to do something. Especially when you're young and you have those hormones and that energy and there are things going on in the world around you, using the arts and using music is essential to success, and vice versa. You know, telling musicians that you need all these people behind you if your song is going to ring true.
Nora Guthrie is Woody Guthrie's daughter and author of My Name is New York, Ramblin' Around Woody Guthrie's Town. It's a CD collection, an audiobook collection with a lot more. And Nora, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
I was standing down in New York town one day. Standing down in New York town one day. I was standing down in New York town one day. Singing, hey.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TiVo. No need to switch TV inputs, remotes, or interfaces to access cable TV and streaming from Netflix and Hulu Plus. Learn more at TiVo.com.
Yes, sir, I was broke, I didn't have a dime.
On this day of airstrikes and escalation in Syria and Iraq, thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.